Okay, so one of the things I've been doing with the guys this year in the yeshiva, which I think is important, and I know Reb Ginsburg touched on this a bit when he was here, I think that's what he told me, is Agada, right? So what I've been doing with my guys is trying to understand what Agada is in general. That was what I did for the first few weeks. And then, you know, I didn't want to just suffice with them with theory. I wanted to get into the nitty-gritty. I wanted to show them how it worked. And since the yeshiva is learning Masechet Avodah Zarah, so I'm now taking them through Agadot in Avodah Zarah to try to understand them and try to show how Agada works in general and then apply it to specific cases. So I took sort of some of the central ideas I've talked about in the last few weeks with them, and I want to take you through the first Agada in Avodah Zarah, which is a fascinating two-page, lengthy Agada. Fascinating, beautiful, hard to penetrate, and I want to try to understand it with all of its complexity. But before we get into the Agada itself, I wanted to make a few introductory comments. And there are many ways we can talk about introduction to Agada. Many people have written introductions to Agada, overviews of how it works. But I want to take it in a slightly different direction. So as I mentioned before, I had the privilege of the last 3 years of being in Toronto. Toronto has...
You say it like a Canadian, I love it.
Yeah. I do my best. My wife doesn't. My wife is Torontonian, but my wife says it... Right, so my wife says Toronto, but I say Toronto. Right, so I tell my wife, everyone thinks I'm the Canadian, she's the New Yorker, but my wife's from Toronto. That's how they knew who I was, because I used to give guest shiurim when I came to visit.
Michael Shore?
No. Byron. If you, yeah. Anyways. Where in Toronto are you from?
Willowdale.
Okay.
Area.
Got it. So my in-laws are in Clanton Park, and I was one of the rabbis in the Bayit.
Oh,
so, Thornhill. So did I. You know. Everyone did, you know. So Toronto, as you know, sorry, what's your name?
Esty.
So Esty knows, Toronto has... had the privilege over the last, it's a very, very old Jewish community, the privilege of the last century and a half or so of being host to some of the most fascinating rabbinic personalities in North America. Some have eventually made it to America, and so Americans know them, and some of them who did not. Right? Like Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky started in Toronto. In the YU world, the Rosenzweigs are from Toronto. Neuburgers are from Toronto. But one of the most interesting people in Toronto's history is Rabbi Avram Price, who outside of Toronto people don't know as well. But he was one of the leaders of Toronto Jewry from the 40s until he passed away at the age of 94, I think, in 1994. And he was an interesting personality, tremendous Talmud Chacham, but also a very, very, very successful businessman and very much an independent thinker. He wasn't beholden to anybody, so he just wrote on whatever interested him. So one of the things that interested him is Agada. He writes two volumes of his Drashot. So they asked me last year to give the annual Yahrzeit lecture for Rabbi Price, so I became familiar with some of his more, his even less known writings. In his introduction to Imre Avraham, which is Book of Drashot, he asked what I think is a very central question to Agada, which is, why is Shas a mess? Right? Why is it an absolute mess? Right? It's 2,711 pages, right? And trying to find anything is extremely difficult. Right? There's a letter in the Rambam where someone wrote to the Rambam and said, "Where did you get this halacha from?" So the Rambam writes back to them and he says, "Well, I think it was in this Masechta, in this Perek." Right? They didn't have Dapim yet; it wasn't printed that way, but okay. He looks, didn't get it. So he writes back to the Rambam. It wasn't there. He says, maybe it was, and he picks another Masechta. And he does this three times. Eventually they find it, and it was a parenthetical comment in a different sugya that had nothing to do with the original context, and that was where it was from. And the Rambam panics, and he says, "I wrote Mishneh Torah. I wrote this book, and I have no idea where I got things from at this point, right? How is anybody else supposed to find anything?" Right? That's true of halacha. But it's even worse, because Agadah is woven in to it, right? The non-halachic portions, whatever that is, right? Agada includes a lot of things, right? I don't know what Reb Ginsburg did and didn't do, but like Rav Ram Ben Aramam just sort of systematically goes through it, Right? Agadah includes stories. It includes pithy aphorisms. It includes, just ethical teachings, right? It includes parshanut on the Torah. It includes all types of things. But all of this non-halachic material is just incorporated into the Gemara. Sometimes because it's vaguely related to the halacha that we're talking about. Sometimes because it was said by the same person who said a series of unrelated halachic statements. So Rav Avram Price asked, he said, why? Right? I mean, they weren't capable of being the Rambam. Right? They couldn't have just written a halachic code and then written the Ein Yaakov on the side. Right? They couldn't have been organized. And why does the Gemara do this? So you could say, well, it was before the age of systematic thinking, which at some level is sort of true, meaning it's, you know, we don't realize how much we've been influenced by it, right? Rav Lichtenstein used to note that many people who believe they haven't been influenced by the outside world don't realize that the very way they write halachic works has been borrowed from academia. Right? He obviously had a PhD from Harvard. He was not ashamed of the fact he was influenced by academia, but he said, nowadays everybody writes what in English we call a monograph. Shmirat Shabbat kehilchata, Hilchot Yom Tov Sheni kehilchata, Hilchot Kippah. Every topic under the sun, right? There are books on everything, and they're monographs. That's what they are. They're halachic monographs, which comes from academia, right? Find some bizarre, little, very minute topic and write a 300-page or 700-page dissertation on it. They don't realize that that's the culture that is in the background that motivates them to write that way. So it could just be that that just wasn't the way people wrote. But Rav Price says it's more than that. I mean, still, even if you don't, right, the codes aren't a thing, still, you can say, look, I'm going to separate legal and non-legal works, right? That's a pretty basic division, right? Chazal were aware of the fact that they were doing that. They were writing different genres. Chazal categorized them, right? They say, Ein lemeidin halacha min ha'agadah. We don't learn law from non-legal passages. They were aware that there were two different passages that they are integrating into the Gemara, and yet they chose to create the Gemara that we have, right? So, yeah.
Okay, but there has to be some sort of reason. There's a method to them happening.
Correct. And that's exactly what Wright Price wanted to know, right? He says, so what is it? Right, so what is it? And what he says, I think, is, right, you're right, there has to be a method to it. And he argues there is. There very much is. And he says, what is it? So this is what he writes in Source 1. He says, "Hadarshanut hayta me'olam chelik chashuv me'od b'safrut shel Toratenu." Right, homiletics, drashot, inspirational teachings have always been an integral part of Torah. V'tavsa makom nichbad b'beit midrashot shel Yisrael. It's always been a central part in our Beit Midrash. Mipnei shebahadrash kovea otzara musari shel Torat Yisrael. He said the reason is because Agadah, homiletics, drashot, they are the ethical storage house of the Torah, right? They are the philosophy, the ethics, the morality behind the law. V'halo halachot v'limudehen musabot ala mitzvot shebetorah, shekol ikaran ela l'shem hashka'at musariyut bivnei adam. And then he says, look, halacha, right? Law, the goal of law is to instill morality into people, right? To improve improve their ethics, improve their philosophy, improve their actions. Kimamaram said, and I'll prove it, because Chazal say, V'chimi ach ma'chpad lo lakadosh baruch hu bein shochet be'ima ve'ochel o nocher ve'ochel. From God's perspective, you think he cares whether you shecht from the front of the neck or from the back, from the nape? Who cares, right? The Torah, the Gemara says, "Kulum atam mawilo, kulum atam maziko." You think you damage God? You think you're benefiting Him? You think He cares, right? He existed before the world. He'll exist after the world, whatever that means. But He does it. Definitely doesn't care. Umachbalo ben ochel mutarot, ochel tmeot. He thinks it matters. You think it matters to Him whether you eat kosher or not? Im chachamta, chachamta lach. If you engaged in wise things, it is for your own sake. Halo natnu mitzvot elet litzaref et habriot shneamar imrot Hashem. Oh God. Imrot something.
Any chabad?
Yeah. What?
With that. that.
What?
Any Chabad rabbi will argue with that vehemently.
Ah.
That God actually does care.
Good. So any, right, so you're right. So in Kabbalah, but it's not just Chabad, right? In Kabbalah, right? In Kabbalah, you're right. Right? In Kabbalah, they'll tell you it's not true. Right? In Kabbalah, they'll tell you it is not true. Right? They will tell you that God does care. That the mitzvot affect the cosmos, or they affect even the Godhead, right? Through the channels, right? There is the guf limala, and there's the guf limata, and every mitzvah that we do is, it is one of these 613 limbs and sinews on the divine body, whatever that means, in non-anthropomorphic terms, but whatever that means, and that we somehow affect it. We somehow perfect the nature of creation. For sure. And in Kabbalah, that is what Mikubalim will tell you. Right? And there's, right, it's not just, right, Chabad. It's any Kabbalist, whether they be Hasidish, or they be a Misnaged, right? Meaning, right, Rechai Balazhin will write this, right, in Nefesh HaChayim, right? And it doesn't matter whether you're talking Zohara Kabbalah, even though it's a little bit less than Zohar Kabbalah. But once you're talking Lurianic Kabbalah, once you're talking post-Arizal, then everybody is talking about this, right? Less before the Arizal, but still a little bit. But the classic sort of Chazal, you know, position is it doesn't matter, right? Mitzvot are here for us, are here to perfect us. So then he says, the Agadah is the Musariyut Atzma. Bidin Shekovat Bracha Miruba Besifratenu. Beraba Miruba. Yeah. It's a bit hard to read this, but it's sort of shrunken down. Besifratenu Shiyu Chachmei Yisrael Munyanimba Lahafrota Lishag Shega Lishapira. He said, therefore, it makes sense. Right? So, what makes sense? He says as follows, right? It makes sense that if halacha is what we do, but it's meant to improve us, and Agadah tells us what it is we're trying to aim at, right? Then it makes sense that those masters of halacha, the masters of those who tell us what to do, should spend time figuring out why we do it. But then he makes what I think is a very simple, but very elegant argument, which is, how do you avoid the possibility or the inevitability that people will forget that there is an idea behind the law?
They do all the time.
They do all the time.
Yeah, I mean,
for sure they do.
So people don't say, what is the value that I'm going to get out of that truth? They should.
Correct.
It's part of the educational system that's failed, I think. But
so
the halacha is made to see a certain moral value.
Exactly.
So back up a quote, because the premise is that this genre is unique, but actually the Chumash is written in the same genre, right?
Correct. The Chumash is written in the
it's this encompassing of story.
Correct. Right. Chumash is interesting, right? Because it's right. Chumash is interesting, right? Because Bereishit is almost entirely narrative.
Right.
Vayikra is 80% law. Shemot, right, Shemot and Bamidbar are very,
so
you know, balanced.
It's, you know, modeling itself on
correct.
An integrative system.
Correct. And I think that's true, right? So we can back up and we can say, right, he says it about the Gemara, but we can say the same thing about Tanakh, right? Why does it do that?
Right?
Was God not aware of the fact that you could distinguish? Right? And the answer that Rabbi Price gives is, sorry, what's your name?
Sorel.
And?
Rachel.
Okay. So the point that both Sorel and Rachel makes, right, is the Torah does the same thing, and yet in our educational system, somehow, the integration is missed. So Rabbi Price said, well, what were Chazal doing? Or what was the Torah doing? It was integrating it to prevent the compartmentalization of what we do from why we do it. Right, the mess of the Torah, so to speak, and the mess of Shas is intentional. It's meant to remind us that there aren't supposed to be sharp distinctions between what we do and why we do it.
Isn't it like it's all fluid?
Yeah, right. It's we're supposed to be thinking about why we do what we do. Right? He says. Right? He makes it very sort of compelling. It's funny. Right? He makes what should be a simple argument. Right, but we don't articulate it. Definitely, in our, you know, often in our educational system, he said, "Look, if the Gemara says that mitzvot are not there for God, they're there for you. But the average person, when they are looking and asking, which Rabbanut is good, Mahadrin Minim Mahadrin, Mihuderet, Hashkacha Pratit, taken over by Tzohar, not taken over by Tzohar, right? How many of them are thinking about the 11, 12, 15 different reasons given for Kashrut? Right? How many of them are thinking, well, I care about this because I'm supposed to learn how to control my appetitive desires. Or I care about Kashrut because it separates me from the non-Jews. Or I care about it because I'm supposed to simply learn to value submission. Or whatever reason you give.
They should.
Yeah. Right?
You should be able to answer somebody if they say, why do you keep Kashrut?
Exactly.
You don't be able to answer.
But what's the problem? The problem is that it's very hard to think that way. So what did we do? Right? We have people who really make our life very easy. Right, we have the Rambam, we have Shulchan Aruch, we have Art Scroll and Koren and every other, right? We have, you know, every book, code, website that basically tries to distill what we need to do. Because sometimes when you need to know what you want to do, you want a code, right? You don't want to, or you want simplicity. You barely want to know where the halacha came from. You want to know what the halacha is, right? You want to know what the halacha is, right? Right? With the internet, we sort of double down on this, right? We go for as clear as possible, right? What are the most successful halachic websites? The ones that people know they can go to, they can get an answer, that are clear, right? There's a reason, right, that yoatzot.org is as successful as it is. There just is, right? It is massively successful because it is extremely clear, right? And if it's not clear and you tell them, they will clarify it, right? I know, my wife is a Yoetzet, right? This is like, you know, this is like my go-to. But, right, there's a reason that people look there. There's a reason people like, I don't know, Ask the Rabbi on Eretz Chemda's website, or because it's clear, right? But the problem is, the clearer you are and the more you isolate what we do from why we do, the easier it is to forget that life isn't that neat. That what we do and why we do are meant to be integrated. Right? So, Rav Price takes that sort of simple, common sense assertion, right, that there should be a connection between what we do and why we do, and says, that's why the Gemara is a mess. Or that's why the Torah is a mess. It's not a mess. Right? There is a method to the madness. The method to the madness is that the Torah didn't want to split those two genres, because then you forget that they're meant to be connected.
That's why you had the Nevi'im. That was their job during the time.
For sure, the Nevi'im are coming in, right? That's the role, well, as he says, that's the role of drasha, right? The role of, right, drashot,
because
we don't have Nevi'im, right? But the role of basically anyone who was ever meant to inspire people was to put the why back in the what. Right? And that's what he continues here, right? And he says, it's a mitzvah. It's important to emphasize the Agadah, right? The ideas, the ethics that are embedded in the halacha. Right? And what does he say they do? He says they stamp, right, into the Agadah their ethics, their common decency. Right? And he says they go farther. Right? I won't read this paragraph. You can read it. But he goes farther and he says it's not just that they mix, right, halacha and Agadah. Right? Rav Schechter claims that 1/7 of Shas is Agadah. I don't know whether that's true. I haven't done the math. He knows Shas much better than I do. I'm gonna take his word for it, right? But it's not like there's a Masechta, which is Agadah, right? It's integrated. But he says more than that. Chazal go out of their way sometimes to not be clear with you, right? And the Ritva makes this point in several places. Sometimes something is not halachic. It's just not. It's common sense. And the Gemara calls it halacha. Asur, mitzvah. Right? And the Ritva says, right? Yeah, sometimes when the Gemara says mitzvah, chayav, obligated, doesn't mean it. It means like it's a good idea. And sometimes things are absolute law, and they're written in like these philosophically sounding statements. So Rabbi Price says, why? Right? It's bad enough we integrate it. Why do we go out of our way to confuse language? Right? Why aren't we like the Rambam? The Rambam is very clear, right? The Rambam tells you something's Biblically, Chayev, he'll tell you, mitzvah de'oraita. If it's rabbinic, mitzvah de'rabanan, mitzvah mi'divrei sofrim. If it's a minhag, he'll say it's a minhag. Right? Why does the Gemara play with your head? He said, because at some level, the Gemara wanted to teach you something very simple. We are here to tell you what to do. And what you're supposed to do is not reducible to what you are biblically obligated to do. There are things you should do because they're the right thing to do, and they're the common sense thing to do. Right? And I will call it mitzvah even though I don't mean that. Right? And that's why he says we integrate not just the placement of halacha and agadah, but we mess with language. Right? The Gemara is intentionally blurry about the line between biblical law and rabbinic law, and sometimes that causes chaos in psak. But Rabbi Price said that was the point. Right? The point was that the Gemara is there to tell you how to live your life. How you live your life includes law, includes custom, it includes common sense, it includes ethics, it includes being aware of why you do what you do. And if you split them, then you would end up doing what people often do, which is compartmentalizing their life. But Chazal and the Torah want you to have an integrated life. They want the why and the what, and law and practice and custom to be all part of your life. Right? Sure, there are times when it's important to know whether something is biblical or rabbinic. Right? If there is a doubt regarding the law, so sure, safek d'oraita l'chumra, safek d'rabanan l'kula. Right? If it's doubtful, so you'll go, you'll be strict. If it's biblical, you'll be lenient. If it's rabbinic, fine. But in the average day, right, when you get up in the morning, you should not be thinking, right, my first priorities are my biblical law, and my second priorities are the rabbinic law, and my third priorities are universal customs, and my fourth priority are things which are common sense. Right? That's not how we live our lives. Right? We get up in the morning, right, and we know we have things to do. I have to go to shul, I have to daven, and I got to make lunch for my kids, and I got to get to work, and I got to, you know, I've got to go to my job, I've got to be ethical at my job, I've got to make sure I'm fulfilling my responsibilities, I have to try to, you know, be nice to my spouse, to not snap at my kids if I'm tired, right? Like, we have all types of things, we don't make these sharp distinctions, we also don't, right? We also, sort of in the back of our minds, know why we do what we do, right? And we don't realistically say, well, I'm doing this because it's a mitzvah d'oraita. I do that because I think family's important. And yes, I could justify it based on Torah source, but we don't do that. That's not how we live life. So the Gemara is as messy as life is because that's a normative claim, right? Life should be integrated.
But is that sort of historically okay because it predates people's question and the notion of if I have to do it, if it's not meaningful to me. Meaning the Rambam was very careful to systematize and to question this notion of tamei mitzvot and the dangers of kind of saying, well, we have to understand it, because then if we understand it...
Right, so...
Meaning there's a danger on the flip side.
For sure.
I have to understand
what I'm doing. So the way I think the Rambam would put it, right, is that there's a danger to reducing law to meaning. Okay. Right? Right, it's the
Gemara wasn't worried about.
Right, you know, the simplest example, right, to sort of think about what we mean that the danger. Let's take a simple example. We can all agree, right? This is not particularly controversial. That the reason that you're supposed to stop at a red light, the reason that law was enacted was to protect the roads, right? To protect people on the roads. We all know that despite the fact that there is nobody in the world who will disagree with that statement, if it's 2 o'clock in the morning and there's nobody on the road and you go to the red light and you run the red light and there's a red light camera, right, and you get a ticket and you try to go to a judge and say, right, you try to give the whole explanation. Well, the law was only set up to protect people on the road and I looked both ways and there's nobody on the road, so you shouldn't give me a ticket. I'll say, that's fine, but it is the rule. It's the law. And therefore, the ticket stands, right? In that case, we all agree on two things, right? One is that we know why, right? In that case, it's easy. We know why the law was instituted. No one's arguing about that. But we don't reduce the law to its reason. Why don't we do it, right? What is the advantage of law, right? Why don't you just tell someone drive safely? Because you know that that's true at 2 in the morning. right? But at 12 in the afternoon, you may not see anybody in the road, but there might be someone rushing along that you didn't see. And therefore, we make a blanket rule to protect the value, but we purposely don't reduce it to the value so that people can't get out of it, right? I think the Rambam thinks the same thing about law in general, right? Which is that law has reasons, but we don't let people say, I've gotten to the depths of the law, and therefore I'm now going to call the shots and decide when the reason applies and when it doesn't, because then it leads to chaos, right? Reducibility is what's dangerous, right? The Rav makes this point in his book on Pesach, Shavuot, and Sukkot, that, right, he said, in the 20th century, we know the dangers of that type of thing, right? This is sort of an easy example, but he says, right, when you say you can't murder, right, so we all think, oh, okay, well, we don't murder. We know why you do that. But once you start philosophizing, we know in the 20th century, people said you don't murder because you're not supposed to murder equals. But if someone isn't an equal, if someone's dangerous to society, they're subhuman, then it's not murder.
It was a Nazi, right? Philosopher.
That's his point. Yeah. Right? He said in the 20th century, we know it, right? So what's the advantage of the Torah saying don't murder, don't kill? The advantage is to say, I'm not leaving this up to you. It may be that the philosophy is clear to you, but you need, as he said, you need a little bit of chok to protect mishpat, right? You need a level of chukiyut, right? Of, you do it, right? A level of lama kacha, right? To protect the person who's going to say lama, because I think such and such, and I don't think such and such.
Leave room for subjectivity.
Exactly. Right? That doesn't mean that the law isn't there for a purpose, and it doesn't mean that you're not supposed to integrate that purpose into your personality. Right? But law has the advantage of telling you that even if you don't get it, right, even if you think it's wrong, you gotta do it anyways. Because the irony of law is we protect values by telling people they can't decide how they act, right, against the law based on their assumption of what the values are. Right, it's sort of a subtle game that we play. Not just us; that's every legal system in the world. That's what it does. Right now, for that reason, there is an override. Right, there's a reason there's an override. It's dangerous, but there is an override. Right, and that's what the Gemara calls akirat davar min haTorah. Right, under certain circumstances, you can uproot the Torah. Right, or in its more radical formulation in Brachot, which is right, eit lasot laShem eferu Toratecha. Right, that. Because it's a time to do for God. And the right thing in this circumstance is to violate the Torah. So then, Navi, Chachamim, have the right under certain circumstances to say the bigger picture will be served by breaking the law under this circumstance. But we don't give that to everybody because, you know, we don't know where that'll go to. But fundamentally, we believe that it's true, and that's why we have to build an override, right? You know, secular law has the same thing, right? Secular law also builds in overrides, right? You can, you know, there's the possibility of breaking the law and saying, you know, and then pleading your case in court and saying, look, this was too egregious, right? Meaning it wasn't just neutral versus, right? It wasn't the running the red light, which is a neutral versus, you know, keeping the law or doing something which is morally neutral but illegal. Sometimes they'll say, look, here the law is counterproductive, and sometimes we'll let you get away with it, right? Not always. It's very dangerous because we want you to think about it, right? Well, civil disobedience, right? You think the law is anti-moral, right? So then you say, look, I'm going to violate the law, and I'm going to accept the consequences, but if the legal system decides that there's a problem, maybe by breaking it and forcing them to think about it, they'll change the law, right? That's sort of what civil disobedience does. But fundamentally, you're right. Right, meaning it's before sort of the era of we only do things because they're meaningful, but it's not before the era of people recognizing that what we do is not always done because it is intrinsically meaningful, but there is a philosophy behind it, even if by definition law has a little bit of a gap, right? It's not reduced to those values. So that's Rabbi Price's sort of global view of Shas, which I think is sort of nice, and it's one of those things, like sometimes, you know, there are always like two types of chidushim, right? There's the type of novel thing that someone says that you could never have thought of. And then there's the type of thing that after they said it, you know, we're all like, you know, that makes a lot of sense. I just never articulated it that way. But like you read Shas and that's really the feeling you get, right? You feel like this is something that teaches me about life. Now, add to this a point that Rav Tzadok HaKohen makes, Okay? Rav Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin, who is not someone I often quote, but at this point I will. But this is a very often quoted piece. Rav Tzadok asks this, and he says, though he doesn't articulate it in the exact same way, but he argues as follows. I'll say this one outside so we can get to the Agadah number 3. This is not just a global statement. Rav Tzadok claims that at least the major Agadot in different Masechtot are there not to shed light on Jewish life in general, but to shed light on the law, the themes of that Masechta. Right? So his example is the Gemara in Gittin. Right? That Gittin, most of the Gemara, most of the Masechta is about divorce law. But smack in the middle is two and a half long pages that we read every year on Tisha B'Av because it's the only thing we can do, right? About the Churban. Right, about the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash. And the Rav Tzadok said, why is it here? And he said, it's here to remind you and to teach you that the mashal, that the psukim used throughout Tanakh, that God and the Jewish people are married, and therefore Churban is a possible divorce, right? As Yeshayahu says in Perek Nun, right? The Jews interpreted Galut as divorce, so God had to say, Ezek Sefer Kritud, right? Where is your get, right? Where is your get? I didn't divorce you. This is, right, this is separation, not divorce. We're in a Catholic marriage, right? So Rav Tzadok says, how do you get that point across? You put the Churban Gemaras in the middle of Gittin to remind us that the entire institution of marriage sheds light on the nature of a relationship with God. The use of that parable teaches us something both about the nature of marriage and the nature of relationship with God. Now, what that nature, how exactly the connection works out is a share for another time. But Rav Tzadok argues that, and this makes sense with what Rabbi Price said, right? If the point of Agadah is to shed light on law, then it makes sense that it doesn't just shed light on law in general, right? Okay, sometimes you have a one-liner, but if you have a 2, 3, 4 blot Agadah, which you do at the beginning of Avodah Zarah, right? Avodah Zarah, we go from halacha, right, like the first few lines, don't do business with non-Jews on their holidays. And then we launch into an Agadah that goes for most of Daf Bet, Daf Gimel, Daf Dalet, right? It just keeps going. We don't pick up on the main theme of the Gemara again until Daf Vav, right? It's all ancillary points until the sixth, until, well, the fifth, or whatever, because there's no Aleph, right? Until Daf Vav, right? So my contention to my guys, and now we're learning about Avodah Zarah, is it has to be, right, that this is here for a reason, right? So what I want to do is I want to start reading this, because it's a fascinating, fascinating Gemara, and I want to try to uncover as much of it as we can. We can't get through everything, but uncover as much of it as we can. So what I've done to make it easier so that we can, you know, go through it, is I'm not going to read everything, but what I've done is I've divided the Gemara, you know, as an outline, into its stages, so that we can describe what is going on and then sort of take pieces of it. So here's the outline of the Gemara. Gemara starts off as follows. Right? We'll read the beginning, and then I'll sort of summarize how it, as it goes on. Darish Rav Chanina Bar Papa, V'itema Rav Simlai. Rav Chanina Bar Papa expounds, or maybe Rav Simlai. Latid lavo mevi HaKadosh Baruch Hu Sefer Torah Manicho Bechekov Omer L'mish Asakba Yavo V'itol Scharo. God, the end of time, whatever this means, will take the Torah, put it in his heart, right, put it in his chest, hold it, and says, anybody who kept this thing, right, this Torah, should come and take his reward. Right, now this is where any Rishon who wrote on Agadah jumps and says, you have to know that Agadah is not literal always, and it can be metaphorical, and the Rashba has a whole commentary on this, right, proving this. Okay, fine. What happens? Miad mitkabtzinu vayinu ovdei kochavim bi'irbuvya. So immediately, all the non-Jewish nations come, they jump up, and they come to God in a mob. Shne'amar kol agem nikbetzu yachtav. Amar lema kadosh baruch hu, al tichnasu lefanai bi'irbuvya. So God says, first of all, let's make order. Right, calm down. Right, I don't need a mob. Everybody divide up. Everybody, each nation come individually. Right, let the nations come in, and Luum is an individual kingdom. And then the Gemara says, "Umika mirubuvia kam egadish baruch hu." Why does God need order? God can't distinguish between the nations. He needs it to be orderly. I understand. I need, right, if 10 students come over and ask me something, I need them one at a time. God could listen to everybody. Why does he care? So he says, no, he doesn't want them to get mixed up. He wants each person to make their own claim and not to steal somebody else's defense, right? If you want a court case, everything has to be yashar. Sumiyad, and now we get several conversations. Sumiyad nechnesa lefana malchut Rome itchila. First, Rome comes in. So the Gemara says, why does Rome come in? So the Gemara says, because they're the most chashuv, they're the most important. And how do we know that we give honor to the most important? And the Gemara goes and proves that. So skip down to the two eyes here, right? That's, as you see, just sort of cut out the arguments here. So Amar Lama Kadosh Baruch Hu, after the Gemara proves why it is important that Rome gets in first, so Rome and God have a conversation. God says, Amar Lama Kadosh Baruch Hu Ma'asakdem. Okay, what did you do? What is your claim to fame? Why do you think you get to go to the world to come? Omrim lefanav, so they say, Ribono shel olam, harbe shvakim tikninu, harbe merchatzaot asinu, harbe kesef zahav hirbinu. We built marketplaces, we built bathhouses, we had so much money. Vikulam lo asinu ela bishvil Yisrael kadeshi dasku betorah. And we promise, we did everything, so the Jews, okay? And they say we promise we did it so that the Jews could learn Torah. That was our motivation. That was it. We wanted the Jews to learn Torah. Amr lemakadosh baruch hu shotim sheba olam. He says, you right idiots, right? Shotim kol mashati sitem l'tzorach atzmechem asitem. Give me a break. You did it for yourself. Tikantem shvakim lo shiv behem zonot. You made marketplaces so you could set up brothels in them. Merchatzaot ladein ba'anatzmechem, right? You didn't make your bathhouses for the Jews. You made it so you could go to the jacuzzi, right? So you could be comfortable. Kesef zahav, and money. You're going to impress me with money. Kesef zahav shalihu. Money is mine. Big deal. So indeed, yatzu malchut romi v'nechnasa malchut pras acharaz, right? So they leave, right, ashamed. And now you got another attempt. Persia comes in. So then the Gemara goes to the same thing. Why does Persia come second? Because they're the second most important. Why are the second most important? Because they prove it from Apostle Gun Daniel. So then they say in 2, D2, Amr Lehem, or 2i, whatever. Amr Lehem HaKadosh Baruch Hu, b'may asaktem. What did you do? Amr Levan Rabbanu Shalom, harbe ksharim gasharnu, harbe krachim kavashnu, harbe mochamot asinu. V'kulam lo asinu el bishvil Yisrael kadesh yasku b'torah. We built bridges, and we made roads, and we waged war, and we did it so the Jews could learn Torah. And the exact same thing, God says, are you kidding me? Right? Shotim sheba olam. You built bridges so that you could collect taxes on them. You made war, big deal. I'm in charge of war. That doesn't impress me. And it goes on and on and on. And nation after nation, right, in 4, right, D4. V'chein l'chol uma v'uma. And each nation comes before God. And then the Gemara asked the obvious question, didn't each nation figure out that this wasn't going to work? So the Gemara says, yeah, but Rome destroyed the Beit HaMikdash. So everyone said, look, Rome, we get it. They're particularly bad. Persia, they built the Beit HaMikdash, right? They help, so maybe they have a better chance. And each nation has an excuse why they're better than the next. Fine. Then the Gemara shifts. And the division I'm using here is mostly from Jeffrey Rubinstein. And he notes, okay, stage one is they try to defend themselves. It doesn't work. Right? Each time it doesn't work. So if you were imagine yourselves, you're these nations at the end of time, and they say to God, okay, it didn't work. We didn't manage to find a schut. So what's your next defense? So this is number 2. Okay, we admit we didn't keep the Torah. We didn't know about it. We didn't. What do you want from us? So then the Gemara launches into a very well-known Agadata, which appears elsewhere but is integrated here, which is, I'm sorry, you got a chance, right? In Chazal's world, Hashem offered the Torah to each nation. So defense number 2, God says, that's very nice. You're right, you didn't get the Torah, but I offered it to you. Right? I offered it to you and you said no. Nice try. Third defense. What's the third defense? Right? If that doesn't work, right? Defense one is we're tzaddikim. That doesn't work. Two is you didn't give us a chance. God says, yes, I did. Right? Three is, right? If you go to three, so God says, Elakach amrim avdei kocham v'nei kodesh baruch hu ribono shel olam Yisrael shekiblua heichen kaimua. They say, well, the Jews didn't do it either. Right? So it's not just us, them too. So then the Gemara launches into this sort of comical thing, which is God said, yes, they did. I promise you, they kept the Torah. And the non-Jewish nations say to God, you can't testify about them. You're biased. Right? You are their father, and they are your son. You are pasule edut. Right? You are a karov. You are a relative. You're out. We don't accept your proof. God says, fine. How about heaven and earth? Can they testify? And the non-Jewish nations say, no, they can't testify either because they're biased. Because the world depends on the Torah being kept. They have a vested interest in saying that the Jews kept the Torah. So God says, fine, I got a better idea. You will testify about them, okay? And then the Gemara integrates like every Agadah that you've ever heard of, right? Nimrod will come and testify about Avram, that he was thrown into the fiery furnace, and that he was willing to sacrifice. Lavan will come and testify about Yaakov, that he kept the Torah when he was in his house, right? Eshet Potipharah will testify about Yosef. Nebuchadnezzar will come and testify about Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. They were willing to be thrown into the fiery furnace. Daryavesh will come and talk about Daniel, that he was willing to daven, even though he was going to be thrown into the lion's den. And then then the Gemara says, and Bildad Hashuchi and Sofer HaNaamati, the Eliphaz HaTimni will come and testify. And this is where all my students, like, eyes went blank, right? The three, right, interlocutors of Eov will come and testify that the Jews kept the Torah. Why them? I don't know. I don't know why that was the last one. I don't know, but okay. So that doesn't work. And then, skip to four. Right, I gave you can see in not in four in the Gemara, but in like number four, I gave you the four shlavim, right? The four stages of the Gemara, right? First, their claim that they have reward, then that they never got the Torah, and then the third, okay, maybe we didn't do it, but the Jews didn't either, and then give us another chance, right? That's the last thing. So they say to God, Amr lefanar bonar shalom, okay, we get it. We aren't meritorious, we've run out of excuses, but please, just give us another chance. So God says, Amr lefanar bonar shalom, t'na lanu mirosh v'na asena. Please, give us another chance. So he says, Amar lanu HaKadosh Baruch Hu shotim sheba'olam. Mi shetarach be'erev Shabbat, yochal b'Shabbat. Mi shelo tarach be'erev Shabbat, mehechan yochal b'Shabbat. He says, nice try. If you cooked on Friday, you'll eat on Shabbos. Right? You come to Friday night dinner and say, oh, I forgot to cook. Well, then I guess you're having rice cakes for dinner, right? That's just, I'm sorry, right? Nothing I can do. But he says, look, I should say that to you, but I'm not going to. I'm nice. Ella, avo pichen, mitzvah kala yeshli. I have one mitzvah. The sukkah shma, it's called sukkah. I got one mitzvah for you. Here's your chance. L'chu v'asu ota. So the Gemara then challenges this. Right? Umi matzad amri hachi, is this fair? V'amr b'shu ben levi, ma'i dechtiv asher anochi mitzav chayom, ayom la'asotam v'lo l'machar la'asotam, ayom la'asotam v'lo ayom l'ital schar. Isn't that not right? Today, meaning in this world, you do mitzvot and you get reward in the world to come. You can't do mitzvot in the world to come. But he says, you're right. But God bent the rules because God isn't out to get people. So God gave him another chance. He shouldn't have, but he did. And why is it such an easy mitzvah? Why was this like, why did God say it's easy? Right? This is like, this, I'm sure that line was not funny in the time of the Chazal, it is funny now, I get that, right? The Gemara says it's an easy mitzvah because it costs nothing. I understand, right? Nowadays, you buy your sukkah, you make your pergola, whatever, it costs a lot of money. But in the time of Chazal, right, you built a little hut and you threw on the leftovers from your field, it really costs nothing. But okay. So what happens? Miyad, kol echad v'echad, no tel v'olech, lo seh sukkah, barosh kago. So everybody says, great, we have another chance. They go up their roof and they build themselves a hut.
HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This is still the non-Jewish nations.
The non-Jewish nations, yes. Okay. Still, right, this story goes on, right? This is over a blot of Gemara, right? By the end, right, it's all the non-Jewish nations, Rome, Persia, everybody, they're all coming, and they're all, right, just imagine the scene, right, that the Gemara is portraying, right? Everyone's getting on the roof and builds a sukkah, and God pulls out the Middle Eastern sun, right? It's 110 degrees, right? V'Kadosh Baruch Hu makdir alem chama b'tkufat tamuz. V'kol achad v'achad mivayed b'sukuto v'yotzei. So everyone kicks their sukkah and leaves. Right? I am not having any of this. It is too hot. I'm going home. Shneamar. V'adkad mosor temo v'neshli chamenu avotemo makdir. So then Gemara says, "Vaha Amar Ena Kadosh Baruch Hu Babichunya Embriotav." Didn't you just say God isn't out to get people? Right? What is this? What, right? He, after all of that, he gives them a mitzvah, and then he pulls out the Middle Eastern sun, and they're schwitzing to death on the top of their roofs. Right? What do you expect from the poor people? So the Gemara says, "Look, Mishum Di Yisrael Nami Zimdi Di Mashkel Tkufat Tamuz Al Chayav Evelu Tzaira." So that's not unfair. Jews do the same thing. Right, I'm just doing exactly what the Jews had to do. And then the Gemara says, what are you talking about? If it's 110 degrees and you can't bear to be in your sukkah, you're allowed to leave. Right? This whole thing makes no sense. Because not only is this not fair, it's not even true. They are allowed to leave. So the Gemara says, Nihi depater bute mi mevate. The Gemara says, and this is crazy, right? You have this eschatological drama, as Jeffrey Rubinstein calls it, right? The Mashiach, and it comes down to what? The Gemara says, it's true, they were allowed to leave the sukkah, but they shouldn't have kicked it on the way out. That's it. That is the end of this. And then it launches to another one. And then the Gemara says, God starts laughing at them, and launches into yet another Agadita about, does God laugh? And the Gemara says, yes, right, during 12 hours of the day, 3 hours a day, he spends playing or laughing, right, from which Soloveitchik in his eulogy for Mendel Zach said, from here you see that the Gemara thinks that Valachta Bidrachav, imitating God, includes having a sense of humor, right? But whatever it might be. This Agadita is so strange, right? It is so odd, right? It is this drama about the point of the universe, the point of the world, the end of time, and it ends with having all the nations of the world on their roof. And the Gemara says, what brought their downfall? Not that they left the sukkah, but they kicked the sukkah on their way out. Right? This is it. So, like I said, we can't go through everything in this Agadita. There's a lot packed into it. But I want to try to take some things out of it. Okay? First, I just gave you a summary. The Rashba, right? The Rashba actually writes a parish on Agadah. Right, it's in the, I don't know if we have a set here, but in the, yeah, maybe over there. But anyway, in the normal set of the Rashba, he actually has a Pirush on Agadah, not in all of Agadah, but he has in this one. And he notes that in this Agadah, there's all types of things packed in. So he says, for example, this Gemara proves or talks about, without telling you, that there is Scharva, not proves, proves the wrong word. It asserts that there is Scharva Onesh, that Torah believes in reward and punishment. It asserts that God has omniscience even of the pratim, right, which the Greeks didn't believe in, that God knew the difference between one nation and the other, right? The whole sort of Greek philosophy, the deist philosophy, was that it wasn't true. There might have been a God, but he doesn't know what's going on with each individual nation. So by saying that everyone comes as a mess and God, right, is able to separate it, he just doesn't for their, right, he separates them for their sake, but from his perspective, he knows who everybody is, even when it's all mixed up, right, is an anti-deist polemic. And then he goes, and he says, why does God say to them that you're stupid, right? Why didn't he just say that's not a mitzvah, right? Why didn't God just say, so you built bridges, that's not a mitzvah, what are you asking? And he said, no, the Gemara is being very careful. It's telling you that there, if you built a bridge for the right reason, it would be a mitzvah and it would make you part of Torah, right? God's argument, right, he said, God's the carefully constructed argument of the Gemara, not that he says you're wrong, it's not valuable to be involved in infrastructure, right? But the claim you should have done it for the right reasons, right? Because secular things are valuable if you have a broader perspective. As the Rashba says, that's what the Gemara is teaching you. Right? It's very careful. It's not telling you that it was an Aveira to build a marketplace. It's not, you don't have to sit and learn Torah all day. It's telling you that had you done it so that people would learn Torah, meaning had you set up infrastructure to have a society which does good things, then you're right. I would have brought you into Olam Haba even though you never opened a Gemara in your life. But that you did it for yourself. Right? You did it. Now the Mefarshim get into, okay, what about mitzvah shrichas kavana? Right? And they say, well, maybe that's only by real mitzvah. This isn't a mitzvah. This is something that's by its nature secular and can be sanctified by having proper intentions. Then he notes that the Gemara's assertion that even God is willing to back out of being a witness for the Jewish people because he's biased tells you how just God is, right? That so to speak, he'd be willing to pull himself out of being a witness to ensure that justice is served. And he notes that, you know, these are some big ideas he pulls out, but you can't be medayik in every little line, right? He says that's not how God works. It tells a story to get you into it, right? If there's some little detail that you don't understand, that's okay. It's a story, right? They're using their imagination a little bit to tell you a story that teaches you ethical lessons, right? So the Rashba goes line for line, and section for section, really, and says, this Agadah is teaching you a whole bunch of very important things. But I want to focus on, we have like 10 minutes left, right? We would say an hour and 10? What? 50 more? Okay, so good. So I'd have to rush. So I want to focus on a few, you know, maybe we'll come back to these, but I want to focus on a few points. First, the big picture. Why is this here? Right, back to what we started with. Right, if the point of Agadah and big Agadah, and this is, right, this by all stretches, right, by all interpretations is a big one. But this one just, this right, is Bet Amud Aleph, Bet Amud Bet, Gimel Amud Aleph, Gimel Amud Bet, and it doesn't end. I just cut it. Right after the discussion of God's sense of humor, right? Why is this here? Why does this start of Avodah Zarah?
Well, it's connected to the halacha that it started out with.
Which is?
Doing the business with the Zion.
Right. So it's connected to the holidays, right? That's how we get into it. But it's even a little bit more than that, right? Because if I push it a little bit farther, why don't we do business with the non-Jews on the holidays?
Right? Well, it's deceitful.
What?
They're deceitful. They're saying, I built these things for you, not for you.
So, I mean, that's talking about them in general, right? So, the Gemara says to avoid Avodah Zarah involvement, right? Because they're going to go thank their gods, right? But that's just the beginning of Avodah Zarah. Later on in Avodah Zarah, we have all types of halachot. We have bishalakum, right? We have, right? You can't eat food cooked by them because we want to avoid, simplest understanding, we want to avoid intermarriage or problematic relationships, right? Mixed dancing, always the end problem. We have a halachot of kashrut, of tefillat kelim, that if you buy any vessel from a non-Jew, you need to bring it to the mikvah, right? Not because of kashrut problems, right? But to add kedusha to it, right? I mean, right? Going to bring something to mikvah has nothing to do with kashrut, right? It has everything to do with, right? Being owned. It's very, very specific. It used to be owned by a non-Jew and is now owned by a Jew, right? That's the only time you need to be tovel something. Or if it was made by a Jew and bought by a Jew, you don't have to be tovel it. If it is owned by a non-Jew and the non-Jew still owns it, you don't need to be tovel it. Right? This is, it's a very specific, people don't always realize this one, but right, I 3 years ago, I think, I was a scholar in residence for Shabbos in Princeton, and there was a visiting professor from Hebrew U at the Institute. Right? The Institute, if you know the Institute, right? It's just like the Institute. It was set up for Albert Einstein, right? It was, it's just the research institute where they invite like the top professors in every field from around the world to do nothing. It's basically kollel for academics, right? Just to learn. And they give you whatever you need so you don't have to worry about anything in life. So most of them, they give them, like they have apartment buildings, right? Princeton is a very big landowner in Princeton, New Jersey. So they have apartment buildings, so they give them an apartment. Because most of them have no kids, one kid, right? Maybe. Right now, this guy, he's a professor at Hebrew U. He had 6 kids, right? So Princeton happened to own like this 8-bedroom house, which is why we were staying there. It's plenty of room. And they provide everything for them. Everything. They gave him a house. It's this huge house with a pool, right, for the year. Everything. Like everything he could need, right? When they have guests, they bring them extra beds. They like sent guest beds. So like for Sukkot, they just asked them, they sent them cots. Like everything you need. So what do? They bought new dishes for him, and they gave it to him, but they keep it at the end of the year. So he never had to bring it to the mikvah. He said, right, because it's theirs. He said, I got there day one, but they didn't give it to me as a present. It was theirs. If it's owned by non-Jews and it's staying with the non-Jews, you don't have to tovel it, right? They do everything for you. So tefillah is very specifically that it's an act we do to sanctify something when it leaves the property of non-Jews and enters into our property, right? It's a very specific halacha. So what is the connection between all those halachot? So I think, right, all those halachot are about one thing, which is, how do we create distance, necessary distance between us and non-Jews? But that forces you to ask a much bigger question, which is, why would we do that? Right? Why is it important for us to maintain our identity? Right? It's very nice to spend 70 plus Dapim and Gemara talking about how we maintain distinctiveness. But if you never spend time talking about why that is important, right? It's talking about Jewish continuity without explaining why it's important for the Jewish people to continue, then what are we doing? So, Avodah Zarah, in a nutshell, is the Masechta which focuses on how do we maintain our distinctiveness and why do we bother? So how does the Gemara start with this drama of, in the end of time, God will say, it all comes down to this, right? This. And anyone who learned this, come to me. And everybody will come and say, well, we were doing that, right? Weren't we? We were building the infrastructure that was necessary for it. And God says, no, you didn't. Right? As the Rashba said, had you bought into the mission, had you built all your civilizations because you wanted to create a framework for Torah and everything it represents to be manifest in this world, that would have been great. But you didn't, because you represented hedonism. You represented yourselves, and the Jews didn't. Now, obviously, this is oversimplification, right? But what I think has to emerge from this is that, right, if we now bring it all together, right, Price's argument, right, Agadah is put there to remind you that there's a why behind the what. Rav Tzadok's addition, that the Agadah is there to shed light on the laws in it. If you ask, why is this Gemara even here? It's here because that's a big question, right? Why is so much of our life about maintaining our distinctiveness? And the answer is because we stand for something that the rest of the world doesn't necessarily stand for. And therefore, the Gemara opens up the Masechta by saying, well, what is that thing? Right? And it gives you this whole drama, right? We stand for Torah. We stand for Torah and everything that's encompassed in that. Now, obviously, right, like I said, that's an oversimplification. But I think the basic claim that that's what it's here for, right, it's here to remind us that it's not arbitrary, and that these separations aren't arbitrary, is important. Now, that doesn't mean, right, the interesting thing about all these halachot is that they don't create absolute division. Right? I mean, you can't eat food that was cooked by a non-Jew unless it can be eaten raw. Unless it's something that is not important enough to be eaten at a king's table. Unless the Jew was involved in the process at some point. Right? You can't drink beer in a non-Jewish bar, but you can in your house with the non-Jew, just not in the bar. Right? Meaning the intentional circumscribed nature of the prohibitions is to set up separation without mandating absolute separation, right? Meaning the laws are not there, right? Very sort of, you know, when you try to actually play them out, they're not there. We all know, right? We all know that we are fully capable of going to a non-Jew's house and eating a meal and asking them to buy kosher on plastic plates, right? We all know that these are circumventable, right? Meaning it doesn't, but what it does do is it creates reminders, right? It forces us to think about our distinctiveness, even in a context where we're focusing on our togetherness, right? Meaning, it's not, Masechta Avodah Zarah isn't necessarily about why they're all evil under all circumstances, but it's about how do we maintain enough distinctiveness to remember that we stand for something different, right? Again, that doesn't mean, I mean, some people will read Avodah Zarah and say they're evil, we're good, right? That's not my tendency to think that way. Right? And but despite that, even if you think all these laws are there to maintain enough separation so that we are at least cognizant of our distinctiveness, that only softens the question. Right? We still have to ask, okay, what is it that makes us distinct? And even if we think that we're all human beings, we all share certain things, which we do, right? Or as the Rashba says, right, even if we believe that someone who isn't keeping Torah but is doing important things in the world and understands that it's for a higher purpose deserves to partake in Olam Haba. Right? We really do believe that. We still have to say, well, what is it we stand for? Right? What is it? What are those values? Right? You need to contemplate that for a little bit. You need to, because as one of my friends likes saying, right, he said, if you don't keep Torah, but you maintain all of these distinctions, right? If you don't believe that in Torah and you maintain all these distinctions, you're just a racist. Right? What makes it not racism, right? I mean, that's the thing, right? What makes it not racist, right, is that you think there's a purpose to maintaining distinctiveness.
That's dangerous.
Right? What?
That's dangerous.
Very. Right? Now, he doesn't mean that to say not. He's just, descriptively, he's saying that, right? Meaning, his point is that people who can't articulate, right? Meaning, his point is people who talk about Jewish continuity without believing in the substance of Judaism, right, and Judaism is just perpetuated and they're post-intermarriage simply because they want there to be more Jews, but they don't know what that means, right? And then people accuse them of, right, racism or, right, xenophobia. At some level, there's not really a defense, right? Meaning, if you don't believe in the values of Torah, but you think that it's important that you're different from everybody else, right, that's literally xenophobia, right? I don't know why it's important to be different than you, but I am different than you. If you can say, look, you're a great person, but I have a mission, and the best way for me to keep my mission is to marry within the fold and to maintain the values within. That doesn't mean I think you're a bad person. Doesn't mean I don't think we can have interaction. Doesn't mean I don't value you. Right? It's just that I have to maintain the distinction because I stand for something that I don't think you need to in the same way I do. Right? There's a differentiation of roles. So then, it's not racist, right? Right? You're not opposed to the other simply for their otherness, right? It's that, right? There's a, right? So this is his, that claim is meant to be provocative. It's not meant to like, right? But it's meant to provoke. It's meant to force people to realize that at some level, discussions about why are we distinct, right? Forced you to really ask the question, what is it we stand for? And if you can articulate what we stand for and how we need to protect it, then you have a coherent, moral, compelling philosophy as to why we do what we do and how we maintain our distinctiveness. And Avodah Zarah comes to tell us you need to maintain distinctiveness, but there's a reason for that. It's not arbitrary. It's not because you have certain genes and they have certain genes, right? It's because you have a mission. You have a particular role in this world, and the best way for you to make sure you do that is to maintain your own identity, right? But that's why Avodah Zarah starts with this drama. Now let me make a second point. Right, that's the big point on Avodah Zarah. What?
I didn't even know there was a clock.
There's a clock. What time am I supposed to finish, and that'll affect how much I do?
10?
What?
11:10.
Okay. Whenever you tell me I have to stop, I'll stop.
Now, right? Start the next class, I think, at 11:10. It's like 11:05.
Okay, so like 5-8 minutes. So that, let's say that that's why it's here. Right? Let's say that's why it's here. How do we get from those huge, big, important questions to the sukkah on the top of the roof and the only difference between Jews and non-Jews being, do you kick the sukkah on the way out? Right? Like, it's like it starts off up there and it like ends comically, right? I mean, I think intentionally comically, right? So here Jeffrey Rubinstein is a very nice article from NYU. And I think he's right. And he says, okay, let's get to content. So what is it, right? There are many, many differences between us and the world. But, okay, what is it we stand for? Does this give us any clue? So he has this very, very sharp analysis. And he says, well, think about it. The Gemara opens up and says, what in its sort of archetypal description of the nations of the world, what do they stand for? And again, this is an archetype, right? It's not saying every person and every non-Jew, but it's an archetype, right? It's a model. What does the Gemara put in their mouths?
They stand for themselves.
They stand for themselves, and what? And how does it express itself?
Developing the world.
What?
Developing
the world. Grandeur. Architecture, infrastructure, war, money, right? All the things that make the world go round. What is the mitzvah? Yes, and he says, you want to find a mitzvah that is the antithesis of that whole philosophy in general, right? It's sukkah. You go on your hut, you go on your roof, in a little hut, with things that doesn't cost any money, right? Shouldn't cost any money. Shouldn't, right? Shouldn't cost money, right? You go up, and you live there, unprotected by the, right? Unprotected, right? Open to the elements, right? And why do you do it? You do it, as the rabbi of my parents will like saying every other year. I'm sure he thinks that people forget it, but that's fine. Rav Amital used to say, he gave the same drasha every year, because he said, I said it the first time because I thought it was important, right? So he said, most people in the five years that they have in yeshiva, right, they'll only be here once, maybe twice for a parsha. Probably once between the army and out Shabbatot and stuff like that. And if you hear it twice, it was important the first time, so it was important the second time too. Right? So he used to say, what does the mitzvah of sukkah teach you? That at the end of the day, the only things that are important in life are the things you manage to be able to bring it with you into the sukkah. Right? You can't fit all your fancy stuff. You can't fit your house. You can't fit your car. You can't fit any of that. You can fit your family. Right, you can come, you can share a Yom Tov meal, you can talk about, you know, you can share Divrei Torah, you can talk about what's important in life. That's what's important, right? In the end of the day, you cut it all down, right? You scrape away all the trappings, right? Life is simple. We stand for those simple, spiritual, family values that you can fit into your sukkah. And Rubenstein argues that the reason the Gemara picks the sukkah is because it's the paradigm, right? Is that everybody else... Right? They stand for all this grandeur, and that's where they think greatness is. But remember, in the end of the day, right, what does it mean to stand for Torah? Mi yagid, right? Mi vachem yagid zot? Can you be spiritual and find meaning when you take that all and throw it out? Do you still have a meaningful life? Yes or no? And sukkah is the mitzvah which is supposed to force us to think about that for a few days.
That's why the kicking it at the end is like very symbolic, because they were like, done. That, like, this is not
right.
Who we are.
Right, and he says so, and then the comic element at the end, right, really brings it together, because he said, look, sukkah is such an easy mitzvah that God tells you, right, you're not even chayav if it's uncomfortable. Right, meaning, this is the mitzvah, I don't even want you to say that life is about sacrifice. I just want you to go in there and focus. If it's too uncomfortable, you can't focus, so leave. I'm okay with that. Right? But when you leave, don't kick it, right? Don't kick it, right? That's it, right? Is don't devalue it, right? That's the whole difference, right? That's the thing, is it takes the whole thing and it reminds us. You know what the difference is, the difference? There are big differences. But in the end of the day, it comes down to when it's uncomfortable, will you, and I'm letting you leave, will you recognize the value in it or will you kick it on your way out? That is it, in a nutshell, right? The whole thing, the whole world comes down to that moment, right? Now, Rubenstein argues that this was probably part of that Chazal did this intentionally and probably gave this like pre-Sukkos, right? Like this is a great rousing Sukkos drasha. Yeah. But now he adds a little bit of humor to it and he says, right, this is also, besides for being a lesson about life, it's also good Sukkos Torah, right? Because he said, I did this with my students and I said, raise your hand if you would do the same thing as the non-Jews in the story, right? And a few of them were honest enough to admit it. The rest of them were not honest enough to admit it. He said, everybody sees themselves in that person, right? We all have that time that there are bees, or it's raining, and we're just so happy to get into the house, right? Right? And the Gemara is telling you, look, I'm not saying you can't go into the house. If there are bees in your sukkah and they're bothering you, you are allowed to go in. That's the halacha, right? That is unquestioned, right? But the Gemara, right, it's very easy, right? This is another sort of lesson to pull out of the Gemara. It's very easy. It's much easier to take Musar if you can pretend that it's outside of you, right? So instead of the Gemara saying, right, why do you hate Sukkot so much? Right, it says, imagine this story, right? The people who kick the Sukkah on the way out, that's them. That's not you, right? You may leave the Sukkah, but you will be unhappy. That's all I'm asking. I'm not asking you to stay in the sukkah when it's uncomfortable. You don't have to. I'm asking you that when you leave, recognize what you're missing out on. That's all I'm asking. Right? So he adds that in addition to the big, highfalutin philosophical messages, it's also good sukkah musar. It's telling them, right, you know, you can take advantage of the kulot, but you shouldn't be happy about it. That's it. But I think what this agadata is, you know, sort of, like I said, I use this agadata with my students to sort of indicate what agadata can do, right? And I think it's a great example, because what does it do? It sheds light on the mitzvot that it mentions. It sheds light on Sukkot, right? The agadata itself sheds light on the entire system of Hilchot Avodah Zarah. Right? It tells us that whole system of maintaining distinction between non-Jews and non-Jews has a point. There's purpose. Don't forget that. Here's a story about it. And without sort of laying it out for you beautifully, it's literally, it's beautiful. Right? It starts you off and you think, okay, I'm getting the answer to this question. What is the difference between us and them? All the way up there. And the Gemara says, nah. It comes down to Sukkah. Right? Is that as an archetype, Jews care about certain basic, simple values, not all the big things out, not infrastructure and civilization, that's all important. But at the end of the day, if you isolate the core, it's everything you can fit in that sukkah. Those basic, simple values can fit in the sukkah, Torah, family, whatever, that's it. Right? You want to boil it down to a nutshell, and the Gemara says, and it's not even like I'm telling you to stay there, right? I'm telling you to value it. That's it. Right? It's, do you value it? It's not even about doing the mitzvah. Right? It's not even about doing the mitzvah. You can leave the sukkah. But don't kick it on your way out. Right? Recognize what it represents. Recognize that it is the antithesis of that archetype. That's all I'm asking. That's it. Boil it down into a nutshell. That is it. And it's, you know, it's beautiful. Right? It's just beautiful how this Agadah, right, reminds us that there's a point to the law. Right? There's a point to our distinctiveness. That the laws of Masechet Avodah Zarah in this case make sense. They have a purpose. They have a telos, right, that they're aimed at. And there's a reason for them. The Gemara also reminds us it's not as hard as you think. I mean, it's hard. But at its core, it's not hard. Right? I mean, you know, the Gemara sort of ironically says it all comes down to the moment where I'm telling you, you don't have to keep the mitzvah. It's all about attitude. Right, if I boil it all down in a word, it's about attitude. That's it. Right? Sometimes you don't have to keep the mitzvot. You don't have to stay in the sukkah. But I want you to recognize it's valuable and what it represents. That's it. And in the course of it, as the Rashba notes, it gets to teach you so many other things. Right? That may be the big picture. But it's a little bit of inspiration for Sukkot, as Rubenstein, you know, notes, to remind us when we are uncomfortable because of the bees and the heat or the rain. Right? To be upset, at least, that we're not in the sukkah. But it reminds us about Schar Va'onesh, which is a big deal. It reminds us that God knows what's going on in the world, which is a big deal. It reminds us that God is a fair judge, which is sort of a big deal. Right? Meaning, in this one agadah, which has a big goal, it takes the advantage, right? It takes advantage of the fact that it's already talking to you to get in as many important lessons as we can, remind you of as many fundamentals. And I think, therefore, this agadah is a really nice, partially because of its length, right, is a good guide to the type of things that agadah does. The way in which it reintegrates philosophy, theology, ethics, morality, attitude back into the law to make sure that we don't miss the big picture. Right? That we don't miss the big shit picture. Because right at the end of the day, this whole story, right, is also meant to inspire you that when you walk out of the sukkah when it's raining, to feel like you lost out on something, right? Which is a prat katan. It's a tiny little halacha in Hilchot Sukkot. But the Gemara tells you this whole story to remind you about why that shouldn't be your attitude. And that's the beauty of what Agadah can do, right? It can imbue even in the slightest little action, whether it be the sukkah or it be right not eating bishul akum or all the things in the Masechet Avodah Zarah. It imbues it with the philosophy. It brings back the inspiration. It reminds us that there's a why to the what. And that, at its best, is what Agadah is supposed to do. So thanks for having me. I had fun. And like I said, there's a taste of what we were doing in Yeshiva, so I figured I'd bring it here.
You were at the Kol Ha'olam.
Yeah, I was the
Rabbi Toshino.
Yes, he's the best.